Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Konnichiwa. Thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your dutiful host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And joining us today is FlixWise co-producer, Martin the Prosecutor. Mr. Martin Kessler.
Why isn't the lifeguard helping that poor lady? She's drowning. Somebody help her.
Ay, ay, ay. Where's my whitefish?
We should just redo that.
Nope, it's Stan.
Okay.
No going back now, Martin. All right. And also joining us in her FlixWise debut is Judge, Jury, and...
Hello, Kitty fan.
Is Judge, Jury, and Executioner Miss Monique Momotron Morgan. I'm just going to call you Mo.
That works.
All right. Love it. Thanks for joining us today, Mo.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this isn't your first time at the podcast rodeo. You were the co-host of your own show, correct?
Yes.
Okay. What was that called?
It's called Beacon Hills After Dark, BHAD podcast, on the wonderful and horrible subject of MTV's Teen Wolf.
Okay. Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to hearing you draw comparisons to Teen Wolf and today's Sight and Sound entry. This week it is Kenji Mizoguchi's 1954 drama, Sancho Daio, or as it's known in our neck of the woods, Sancho the Bailiff. This is the second Mizoguchi film we've covered on this podcast, the first being the Sight and Sound film Ugetsu Monogatari. Listen up to hear our take on this other Japanese masterpiece. Then, for our second topic, we're going to talk about long takes. Mizoguchi is renowned for his use of the perfectly composed scrolling shot, which seamlessly both establishes a scene and reveals its meaning while never employing a cut or any typical editing structures. What Mizoguchi accomplishes is unique to his filmmaking style, and yet he is not the only filmmaker to employ the long take. We're going to talk about other filmmakers who likewise choose to take their time between cuts, and we'll each list off some of our favorite long takes in cinema history. Fair warning, if either of you pick Birdman, you're getting kicked off the show.
You know, to be an a-hole, I was almost going to say that, but no. That wasn't even the first pick. I just wanted to be an a-hole and
okay.
Say that.
All right, well, you have some time to think about it. Between now and between our Sancho discussion, and then I'm sure we'll come up with some other good ones. And then finally we'll close things out with some final notes of positivity. All right, you guys, you ready?
Ready.
Ready.
I think
it's a rocky journey ahead of us. I can tell. First up, we have Kenji Mizoguchi's 1954 classic feature, Sancho the Bailiff. As with all Mizoguchi films, Sancho offers a sorrowful meditation on man's cruelty and inhumanity towards his fellow man, and how women seem to bear the brunt of said cruelty. In the case of Sancho, it is Tamaki and her family who find themselves at the mercy of people's worst impulses. The story is set in feudal Japan, where Tamaki lives as a governor's wife, in good social standing with her friends and community. That is until her husband's politics prove too progressive for this provincial town, and they banish him from the region. Unmoored by the stripping of her title and privilege, and forcefully separated from her husband, Tamaki sets out to reunite with her exiled partner. She leaves the village with her two children, her son Zuzio and her daughter Anju, and together they set out to find their missing patriarch. But before they even figure out which way is north, they find themselves deceived by someone they believe to be a benevolent stranger, but who turns out to be in bed with some slave traders. Tamaki is taken by boat to an island called Sado, where she is forced into a life of prostitution. Her children are sold as slaves to a corrupt politician, the titular Sancho the Bailiff, and are conscribed to a life of backbreaking labor, starvation, and misery. The film then leaps forward in time 10 years after Tamaki's son, Zuzio, has long forgotten what it was like to dream of a better future. However, her grown-up daughter, Anju, holds on tight to the flickering memories of her family and implores Yuchiho to never give up hope that they will one day be reunited with their mother. Sancho the Bailiff is no doubt one of the tougher watches we've had in a while. However, the depression-inducing subject matter is delivered with Mizoguchi's delicate and respectful humanism. As a result, the film's message doesn't have a pummeling effect. There are no fingers wagging or lessons to be learned. Mizoguchi is simply asking us to meditate on how we treat the weakest and poorest among us and what that says about us as a species. Okay, so maybe there are some lessons to be learned. But does this message still resonate enough to justify that 59th spot on the Sight and Sound Critics poll? We shall discuss. Before we get started, I just want to tell listeners the reason my voice sounds like it does is because I'm a little sick today. Hopefully it's not too distracting, but I just want to give you fair warning. And if, in case I'm extra low energy today, that is the reason. But I'm confident that Martin and Mo are going to pick up the slack. So without further ado, Martin, let's start with you. Do you like Sancho the Bailiff?
I do. I think probably more than most of the films we've talked about in the Sight and Sound list lately.
Okay.
I think it's so layered with all these little ironies or complexities that anytime I think it's about to make sort of a broader message, it sort of offsets that by, I think, depicting some of the real complexity of life. And we kind of complimented Ugetsu for its snappier pace, but I actually think I prefer this more drifting pace of Sancho, where I can kind of, I have time to contemplate what I'm really watching while I'm watching it. And every so often something will just come into focus and get at the heart of me, I guess. I think it also has maybe my favorite shot in any film, so maybe that's something we could talk about after.
Yes, I think that might come up.
I like it a lot.
Okay. All right. Mo, how do you feel about Sancho the Bailiff?
It's actually one of my favorites for him. It's probably the one right after Osaka Elegy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely in my top 10 for favorite classic Japanese films.
Okay. Nice. Tell me, when did you first see it?
The first time I saw it was in high school, and I only saw a part of it for some odd reason. I never saw the whole thing, and then I didn't see the entire film until college when I was working for my Japanese cinema class.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so what is it? I mean, do you consider yourself like a big fan of Japanese cinema? I know when we were talking on Twitter, you were like, if you ever talk about Mizoguchi again, I want in.
Yeah.
So what is it that draws you to his work?
I
guess specifically our Japanese work in general, and then specifically Mizoguchi films.
Well, I've always loved film. I always liked a lot of, I always kind of gravitated towards non-Western films. And I think kind of, I don't know, I've always been kind of drawn to these stories of Japanese and Korean and Chinese cultures, outside of, you know, Black cinema. Black. weird. No, I think actually what it was, I just got more exposed to the stories and the way that they're described and the way that they move. There's a different sensibility to them. And for him, there is a way that he tells, especially for female characters, a way that he holds their story and the way that he kind of, I like how you said drift, but I feel like he kind of gives it a chance to unfold naturally. It's very organic to me with a lot of his stories. And that always drew me, especially, you know, with so much of his work that I've seen. I've seen stuff from his 30s. As well as stuff from his 40s and 50s. And to me, that was interesting because I've seen films that didn't always hold my attention like they do. For some weird reason, his films always hold my attention. And this particular film is the same way. There's something about it that you just don't want to look away.
Right, yeah. And I mean, it's purposefully slow moving, right? Like, I think a lot of people might find their attentions drifting, but I don't know. There's something weirdly compelling Not weirdly. It's just compelling, despite the kind of, you know, the way that the film unfolds, of a slower pace.
It held the attention of my boyfriend, who, for slow films, those are things that he hates the most. Mm-hmm. And he actually was completely into the film. He stayed with it. He said that was one of his favorite films. It was his first time actually watching it with me last week.
All right.
And we watched it with another friend who loves film but had never really watched a lot of Japanese cinema. He didn't really know anything by Mizoguchi, and he loved it. He's like, I'm going to go and look at all his work. And I'm like, yes.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I think that was sort of my experience. Like, you get a taste for Mizoguchi, and I think you're hooked. I don't know. Because maybe it's because you feel, like, the sense of discovery with Mizoguchi that you maybe don't have with someone like Kurosawa or Ozu, who are so kind of ubiquitous and almost synonymous with Japanese cinema.
Yes.
But there is this sort of thrill of discovery with him because he does feel so ahead of his time. Certainly, as you say, with his focus on female protagonists. But let's talk about female protagonists. Let's talk about ladies. That's sort of a recurring theme in his work, is kind of how life is unfair for women. And life is unfair for everyone. People are generally not treated very well in Mizoguchi films. But women are given so little agency. And he recognizes how little agency women are given, and he sees that as particularly unfair. And somehow it's never, he doesn't make kind of, they're not didactic, and yet his message is very clear. And it's just kind of by humanizing figures that in other filmmakers' work might be relegated to the sidelines or as kind of prizes to be won. But in the case of Sancho, he doesn't actually have exclusively a female protagonist, even though I sort of framed it that way in my intro. A great deal of the story does center around the son. Nevertheless, how does this film kind of relate to his earlier thematic material?
Well, I was actually going to say, for me, even though this is actually one of the rare ones where he actually is a male as a center, mm-hmm. to me, she actually plays such a vital role in the story and how the story moves, mm-hmm. that to me, she still plays she's kind of like the heart of the film. I'm talking about Anju, for those who don't know. She is both the mother, and the thing is that we kind of forget that the mother also moves the story, because we are still seeing what she sees and what's happening to her from time to time. So, you know, where he could have just forgotten the mother until the very end, but he kept the story going and still making sure that you knew exactly where the mother and how she was suffering. Where Anju, you know, with her, the story is that she's the one who kept the mother's memory. She's the one who didn't allow the slavery to change her. And she's really the reason why he even escapes. And mm-hmm. her death, whether he knows it, because, you know, he didn't know that she died until she sorry, spoiler alert for fans.
Yeah, we should be warning, if you've not seen it. Stop right here.
Sorry.
That's okay. Go ahead.
I would like to meet the person, though, who says, yeah. Well, I'm going to watch it, but first I'd better listen to this podcast.
They're out there, I assure you.
For me, her, and I'm going to come back to this later when I talk about this shot, her death really kind of creates those waves of what actually happened. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Yeah. It really is her putting everything into play. And
is that a pun, by the way?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm that person.
It's a rippling effect, if you will.
Yeah. I'm that person who will make those comments. Aye, aye, aye. I'm sorry. Sort of giving you a warning. But it really, you know, and where the other stories that he's done really centered on those characters, and if you look at, like, Sisters of the Gion and stuff like that, it's those interactions that kind of keep them moving. It's those sensibilities that the women in the films and their courage, a lot of times, that keeps his films going. And I still see that even in this film, even though it was mainly a male character. You know, the entire story really is about hope, and it's about redemption, and it's the sister that gives him hope. It's the sister that sets him in on that journey of redemption. And it's that mother that creates the song that brings and keeps her hoping that her kids will come back to her one day. It's that song that the mother creates that gives hope to those children that the mother's still alive. So to me, it's he still, in a way, brought that story back to the female.
Yeah.
No, I think that's exactly right. And of course, that the sister's moral decision is at the center of the film. And even after she dies, I think you still feel her presence throughout the film. Like you said, I think that's exactly right about the rippling outwards, the effect it has.
Again, we're going to keep just, hammering like, that.
Even
fun.
The fact
okay.
that she's, well, I mean, it's a great, it's yeah. a great metaphor for what happens. You know, I think it's actually very apt. And I mean, that is my favorite shot of her killing herself by walking yeah. into the water. You know, it's so tranquil, her being absorbed into the landscape.
It was beautiful.
And you have all these great landscape shots in the film. They're not just like, oh, pretty establishing shots. I think you're meant to take that understanding that, you know, she's part of that. That pan, the final shot of the film, when the son and mother are finally reunited and it pans away from them and you get this panorama, you know, it's not just a pretty shot. You know, there's definitely, I think, a subtext of the suffering of the people who have been who haven't made it to the mm-hmm. end of the story. You know that of course people died during the tsunami. Like, you know, even though the mother survived, like she could have been just like them. And I think one thing that's very interesting about the film is the way it sort of expands your empathy outwards. I always think of the shots where you have branches coming into frame or things that sort of extend outside of the frame. It's always sort of reminding you that you're only seeing a small piece of this world and that there's other people with their own experiences. And I think you're meant to extrapolate. You know, there's that line for he says that he thinks people are only really sympathetic to things that directly concern them. And I think one accomplishment of the film is it tries to get you outside of that mindset and understand the grandeur of you know, human suffering. And I think again in that shot, her descent, like I sort of think it's like an interesting counterpoint to that famous Caspar David Friedrich painting, the Wanderer Above the Sea of Fog, where you also have this figure from behind, but it's like a guy who's about to conquer nature, you know, and like all the subtle differences, I think, show that difference in ideology that you mentioned when you were talking about the difference maybe between Japanese cinema and Western cinema, where I think like all the little differences, the way the branches enter frame, I think it's saying, you know, we're not separate from nature, we're a part of it.
Exactly.
That, you know, maybe the common denominator of life is suffering and that death is maybe the end of that suffering, but one person's suffering is the suffering of the world.
And they actually have a term for that. And it actually, I can't think of the term right off. It's like Kanashimi no Nijin or something like that. I'll have to look it up and retell you, but...
But, you know, there's a whole philosophy in that image. You can just see it, yeah.
It's a common theme in a lot of Japanese films that, you know, the connection to nature. I mean, it even goes into, like, anime. It goes into so much of their work. Where you see that connection between nature and human and suffering and humanity. And it's, they play on that a lot in their films. And to me, this is one of the best examples of it.
Right. And as we previously discussed in our Ugetsu episode, there's this recurring image of the treacherous body of water that the characters must cross. And here we see that again. And also, as Martin mentioned in the ending with the tsunami, and these are sort of, I don't know, what do you think that is that... Mizoguchi uses water as a kind of metaphor for danger and suffering?
I guess it's you know, the fluid uncertainty of it. The you know, I think that's maybe also an effective metaphor for the transitory nature of life. We sort of talked a little bit about it during Ogetsu, but the way water flows, the way life flows, you know, it can take life or it can turn a wealthy person into a slave as soon as they cross the water, or the way that the water separates them. You know, I think it's also important that the mother's on an island and can't leave.
I mean, and it's also I think in the beginning it's the mother getting water.
Yes.
It's also this sort of life-giving property as well, but when there's too much of it, it becomes a source of great pain. But yeah, it's interesting. And then so the tsunami at the end, I mean, it's very it's a sort of great metaphor for as you say, the tempestuousness of life, and how if you're able to weather the storm, you don't necessarily come out stronger at the end. Mm-hmm. You're kind of just kind of washed up seaweed. Right.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, to bring up the ripples again, like I think it's interesting also the idea of how an act of compassion can ripple outwards, or how an act of cruelty can ripple outwards. I don't know if it's a wheel of samsara or the Buddhist sort of philosophy behind that, but like I think there's sort of a sense that some of these things aren't actually resolved by the end of the story. They're going to continue. You know, I thought it was interesting that after everyone's liberated from under the cruel Sancho the bailiff, they burn his mansion down, and it's not just him, but it's his family too, who's exiled. And I almost thought, you know, the same thing might happen to Sancho's family, and it could be the sort of perpetuation of these cruelties.
Yeah. Let's talk about long takes, shall we? I know we have a whole other topic about this subject, but let's talk about it as it applies to this film. I love the way that Mizoguchi composes his shots, because when we think about, I mean, I think of him as being kind of a forebearer of like the great long take.
Yes.
And it contributes to the kind of slow, meditative pace of the film, but everything deliberately unfolds through these extended shots, and you can see, you get a sense exactly of the surroundings, and where our characters fit in amongst those surroundings. So, as Martin, you pointed out, that there's sort of nature intruding in the various frames, it's also that you see the nature, you get a sense of the nature, and then you get also, in addition, you also get a sense of the character. So there's like this wider worldview in addition to what's happening with the characters. So, but yeah, what do you guys make of his formal style?
Well, normally whenever anyone talks about like long takes, I usually mention him or Ozu.
Okay.
So Ozu, you know, kept his camera still. I always like the fact that he did these long takes so that we took it in. And I studied art history, and to me, it just always reminds me of when you stand in front of a painting and you just take everything in. Mm-hmm. And to me, I think that's how he saw nature in his film. That's how he saw nature in this particular world. I think he made sure that you saw it as being grand, but there's still this moment of humans living and spending their lives in this majestic world that doesn't seem to change. You know, everything else is changing around them, but the one thing that stays stationary is the nature, you know?
Right.
And I personally love his technique. I think it's beautiful. I think there's so many moments that I can remember from this particular film as well as other ones. Like, I remember when she was, you know, the mother was just looking into the sea, and they stopped on that. And I thought that was beautiful. Because there's so many days you know, we've all done it, you know, where we've just mm-hmm. looked into the sky or looked into, you know, if we've been to the ocean, just look out at it and just can't stop staring. Right. And you felt the longing. And to me, the moments that he does his long takes speak sometimes louder than the words that are spoken. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I think that's really important. I think that's actually what makes, in general, Japanese cinema a little bit more special to me. But in particular, his work, because it is those silent moments. And I think he uses those to really emphasize. And if you look in the conjunction of when he uses his music, his music's in those long takes. It's that flute. It's that harp. That's when the theme starts to really play and pull you in.
Absolutely, yeah. Martin, did you have anything you wanted to add about his formal style?
I'm in agreement. I have, I think, much the same experience when I'm watching it. It sort of made me think of when you go for a walk, how you're moving past the landscape, but not as quickly as when you're driving, so you can sort of soak it in and you have time to think. And I'm never bored while I watch his shots, watch his long takes. You know, I'm very aware of the image. I'm looking at the image and soaking it in, but I'm also thinking about things outside of that particular moment. And even like, even outside of his natural environments, the artificial environments, like Sancho's property at a certain point, because of the awareness you have of that environment, the way he shoots it, they started making connections to you know, how it's like a maybe a Nazi concentration camp or things like that. I can sort of contemplate where the image fits into other ideas, other places. I think almost every image has that quality. I think Mizoguchi was a real visual, maybe not just storyteller, but he was really visually articulate.
I'm curious, where do you think the point of view of the camera is? Is it sort of the omniscient, all-knowing presence that's like kind of tells you exactly where you should look? Or is it kind of, I don't know, who do you think is looking at these people?
I mean, I always sort of think of it as it's Mizoguchi's point of view.
I guess that sort of struck me, is that at no point do we really see a POV shot. I guess maybe one could argue that the mother sitting out on the beach is kind of her POV.
It's almost like a Tarkovsky film where you have those shots of the backs of people's heads, right. And you're sort of thinking about what they're seeing. You know, it's not quite putting you in their behind their eyes. It's sort of letting you consider what's going on behind their eyes. I think it's interesting.
For me, I never have seen any of. I personally never think of any of his films as having personal POV, especially this one. I always feel like he's one of those people that it's like, I'm taking you into this world, I'm letting you see moments in this world, and then I'm taking you away.
Right.
I feel like it's just that kind of, I'm opening this veil, this, you know, this curtain. Because I, especially, you know, with that ending shot where he shows them hugging, and then pulls away. It's just like, you know what? Now I'm bringing you out of this world. It's the end. I feel like there is no all-knowing. I feel like it's just he's showing you these glimpses and these moments in these people's lives, their perspective, and what's happening around them, and then we're done. I feel like he never really says this is their POV.
Right. Yeah. He says consider this, but there's no. But he doesn't really take us inside of their psyches, and I don't think that's his aim. It's more the broader worldview that he's asking us to consider. So let's talk about politics, shall we? Why not? So this is very overtly political, in that the son gets a career through happenstance, through his birthright as a governor, this is, I mean, certainly there are political elements in other Mizoguchi films. I'm thinking of Street of Shame, or as Martin calls it, how do you say it in Japanese? They say it so well. Look at you. But that, yeah, that certainly had overtly political elements. But here we get the point of view of the, we kind of get the House of Cards version of a Mizoguchi film, in that there is lots of wonkish policy concerns. But what do you make of the son's decision to quit politics? Like, he has a chance to free the slaves who are living on under Sancho the Bailiff's rule.
Well,
and he does that, and then abruptly walks away. What do you make of that decision?
Well, for that personally, you kind of have to know the Japanese idea of what giri is, which is a sense of obligation. Usually it's a sense of obligation to family, to a neighborhood, to a community. It's an obligation to, like, I guess you can say, like, a business or a job. Japanese people really believe in that. They really believe in keeping that honor. Mm-hmm. And in a way, he wanted to keep an obligation to his family, but he also knew he had an obligation to his job, and he knew he shouldn't bypass these rules. But because of his own suffering and his sister's suffering, and the fact that he knew these people were suffering under this type of environment, which he didn't know originally being young, and, you know, obviously his father and other people turned a blind eye to it, he technically broke the law. Mm-hmm. In a way that was unheard of, because that was the thing. They always, and that was something they kept mentioning, is the fact that, you know, you don't have the right to say these people can't own slaves. They kept saying, well, this man is actually under the protection of the, the Master of the North, whatever they called him.
Magistrate?
Yeah, the Magistrate of the North.
Yeah.
You know, so he knew he was overstepping his rules, and a part of the Giri thing is the idea of knowing when you have your honor at a certain point, and he resigned to show his respect to the people that were slaves like himself, and to still give honor to that job, that he still respected the position of that job. He did it too to show that, you know, he still has some respect for himself as a man, and he wanted, you know, that's where they kind of bring up the whole concept of, you know, the fact that his dad in the beginning taught him that you work for the people. You know, it was something that his father mentioned. It was something that mm-hmm. they mentioned in those moments of politics, you know? And yeah. It really showed that in the end, he lost the thing that gave him hope, which was his sister. So in that honor and obligation to his family, he could have stayed as a governor. It became an official, but he decided he was still a man, and he went to search for his mother. And I think that was showing that the obligation to the family was still more important. And I thought that was really interesting. I will point out, though, something that's interesting, because this movie was made in, it was, what, 54? Mm-hmm. The idea of the whole all men are created equal thing, that they kind of pushed in there, along with, you know, their Buddhist thing, that's a concept that was actually given to the Japanese Constitution through American Occupy, you know. Like, mm-hmm. a lot of people don't realize that. You know, they purposely kind of put this in their constitution. So he's also relating this to these ideas that America gave. Because we don't always talk about how, and it's very obvious too with even Kurosawa's films and other directors from that time, of how Japanese culture changed in film before and after the war.
It was massively influenced by America's occupation. Mm-hmm.
And this film, especially with that concept, definitely shows it, you know? But again, I think the main thing is it's that Japanese idea of honor and obligation, which is something that we don't always have here, something that we don't always have a concept of here, you know? There are definitely plenty of movies, especially modern movies, that talk about someone's dedication to a job. I've seen movies where Kimiko the treasure hunter, her obligation to her job, she was treated horribly at that job.
Yeah.
But she stayed with it because of that obligation, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
And you see that. There's a lot of, I have friends who are Japanese who are, you know, you tell them, I want you to get out of this job, this position, but they're obligated to their family, they're obligated to their community. And it's just that I'm rambling, so stop me.
No, it's interesting. It's interesting to think about this film. The governor figure, their father, is kind of the feudal John Locke. It's this sort of anachronism, I mean, yeah.
The father, I think, though, like, there's also this little irony, little bit of irony in that they talk about how compassionate he is to the people he's governing, but it comes at the cost of basically the well-being of his own family. They're put into exile, and then you see how that goes. So, like, it almost makes me think of like the man in Tarkovsky's Sacrifice, mm-hmm. who say, like, I'll sacrifice my family if you know, save the world, God. And it's like, well, it's not really yours to sacrifice. Yeah. You know, and I think in that way, the son's obligation to the mother, I think, shows that he's actually maybe a better person than his father was. And I mean, there's definitely like a political dimension. And I think you're right that, like, even though the film's set in the distant past, it's very much about 20th century ideas. And I think it's definitely connecting the feudalism with more modern, I guess, capitalistic social structures. But, like, I almost think of this more as a moral film rather than a political film. Not, like, moralizing, but American films, there's often this sort of opportunistic morality where doing the right thing is rewarded and the wrong thing is punished. And I think, like, that can be so untrue to life, you know. Sometimes doing the right thing, the real right thing, can have consequences, enormous consequences, but morality shouldn't evaporate when you face that, because, you know, those are the moments when it actually matters. You know, morality doesn't come from nature. I don't think it's amoral, and it doesn't come from God or gods. So, like, I think it has to come from people who strive to be moral, no matter the consequences. I think that's one thing I get out of this film.
And I agree with you. I mean, the sister, if you really look at it, was the moral compass of the movie. You know, she's the one who's constantly telling her brother to return to his values, to the family, her father, their father's teaching. So, I mean, I definitely agree with you on that.
Right.
I think if it was, like, it could have ended with him becoming governor, and it would be like all those years he endured were all right because he never really belonged there. And, you know, but, like, this isn't Oliver Twist. I think that line about, you know, a slave becoming governor, that's a true fairy tale. I think he sort of understands that, and it's not about the fairy tale. I think the film, ultimately, it's about sort of a deeper emotional truth.
Right. Yeah. I did not to psychoanalyze Mizoguchi, but I should mention that his sister was sold into slavery when he was very young, and I think it is said to have affected him deeply, him and his work greatly. So when you say that the sister is the moral compass of the film, it's definitely possible that there's some kind of autobiographical elements in the story, and his sort of deifying of her martyrdom. Maybe it's unfair to call her a martyr. But I certainly think of her
that
way.
I
consider her a martyr in the movie. And that's the thing, too. A lot of people also don't realize his family actually was, like, middle or high class originally. I think they were more middle class, but I don't remember right offhand. But, you know, the war really cost them, you know. Well, and by war, I mean, I'm talking about the Russo-Japanese War.
Right.
That actually drove him to poverty, or close to poverty. So I think it is kind of self-reflective in the movie. Mm-hmm. You know, and then Sanzo is actually based on a short story. Mm-hmm. And the short story, I think maybe he read it and he felt a connection to it. And I think maybe that was why he even made the film, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting that it's called Sancho the Bailiff. I don't know. He seems such a minor character in the story. I mean, and yet he obviously looms large, but it's not Sancho's story.
Yeah, and
out of all the people,
that's actually because of the actual original story was called Sancho the Steward, and it's just more about the terror and the idea of this man who owns slaves. more than, and it was really about the struggle of the family. And I think I kind of like the fact that it's named after someone that you don't really see in the story, in the movie, because, you know, when you're, the entire time you're like, okay, this movie's named after this person. Who is this all defying, you know, this person who's putting, because, you know, you have kind of a fear of, oh my God, they're about to go to this man who they keep talking about with, and who the movie's named after, and you're like, who is this imposing man? And then you see this, like, older...
this scraggly-looking dude, yeah.
Yeah.
totally.
You know, and you understand these kids, you know, who come from a world where they never had to really do anything for themselves. Now they're at the subject of this man who they probably would never associate any time in their life, you know, and they're brought to their knees by this man's cruelty. And even the way that he's disposed of is so easy, you know?
Yeah, it's ordinary. Everything about Sancho is ordinary, right?
I think the reason it's named after the villain is it's more about the mentality and the, and I don't want to say journey, but I guess the experience that these kids go through, and particularly this man, Susio, of what happens to his family when they're going towards him, towards Sanzo and the area that Sanzo lives, and their experience while they live there, and how their mentality changes, and then the mentality away from him, and how he, in a way, this man we barely see in the movie, defined them.
Yeah.
I don't think he was meant to ever play a really big role. Yeah. And I just think it was more about, you know, this man's cruelty among all these people. And if you think about it, it's his son who actually is pretty nice, Taro.
Right.
The one who's becoming the priest. And it's just showing that these people, even in a minor way, changed their lives.
Right. Yeah. All right. I think that's a good place to end the conversation, but we do have one final question left. Sancho the Bailiff is the 59th movie on the Sight and Sound International Critics Poll. Do we think it is worthy of the 59th spot? Mo, let's start with you. What do you think?
I think it should be higher.
Higher. I love it. Yes. Higher than Ugetsu, perhaps? Do they switch places?
Oh.
Ugetsu, I believe, is at number 50.
See, I feel like that should be higher, too. But then again, my favorite film out of his entire series is Osaka Eulogy. And, like, almost no one ever, like, knows that film. So maybe that's just me.
Oh, sorry. No, like his contemporary films are so underrated. It's like frustrating.
It is. Yeah. It's such a beautiful film, and it really captures the 30s so well. And it's just like, just give it to me. But for me, I also like Sekiro the Gaon more than Ugetsu, but I understand why Ugetsu is so important, especially for Japanese cinema. And especially since, you know, it won the Silver Lion, and, you know, I know the history behind it. I personally think because this film is it's that constant feel of being hopeful even though you're losing hope, and in the end you still kind of regain that hope. It's kind of that story of redemption. I think people should revisit it, especially in this time that we're living in right now.
I absolutely agree with that. Yep.
I feel personally I would put it higher. I think it's a personal concept. I think it's going to be subjective. I think people who understand what he's talking about and the people who will be more open to seeing that view will rate it higher. But I feel personally, I think for me, it would be higher than 59. I feel like 59 is so low for this film.
That's totally fair. Yeah, absolutely. Martin, what do you think?
I think it should be much, much higher. I don't know. So many other films just feel like crass after watching this, you know? Like, I think there should be a Mizoguchi film, I think, in the top 10 for me. You know,
I think
this could be it. I would be fine with that if I saw that.
Honestly, when I look at the top 10, I could replace most of the things on there, except for Citizen Kane, with this movie.
It's interesting because Mizoguchi is brought up when you talk about classic Japanese directors, but he's so well respected in Japan. Yes, and it's really the Western world that doesn't know him. And I think that's always really interesting. I feel like maybe we were never ready for his work.
Mm, that's possible. Yeah. But I think we can agree that needs to be remedied. Mm-hmm. And a higher position on the Sight and Sound list would go a long way in doing that. As we just talked about, today's Sight and Sound entry, Sancho Dio, is renowned for its use of the long take and the way that the world seems to unfurl little by little through this mechanism. But Sancho Dio isn't alone in its use of this formal device. Our last three Sight and Sound entries have been a veritable goldmine of elongated shots and single take scenes. We've addressed and celebrated the choreography and camera work in all these films. For the record, I'm talking about Touch of Evil and Barry Lyndon as well. But it's time we finally tackle the long take head on and the effect of making the viewer hang with the camera for an extended period of time. And then, of course, we'll each list five of our favorites or so. All right, so let's talk long take, shall we? I guess there are different kinds of long takes. And when we talk about a long take, I think a lot of people think about, you know, that opening of Touch of Evil or... you know, Birdman or Victoria or all those really those sort of like expertly composed, choreographed shots that are sort of dazzling. But there are all different kinds of long takes and they serve all different kinds of purposes. So what do you think of when you think of long takes? Martin, let's start with you.
Sure. No, it's true. Like there's a big difference between all the different types of long takes. Like, you know, you put an Antonioni long take next to an Alexis Guerman long take and it's like not the same. It almost feels like not the same technique, or a Bellatar long take next to a Chantal Ackerman long take. It's completely different, you know. So I what I usually think of most, it's the composition and the kinetics, what's moving in front of the camera or how the camera moves. So in some cases it's you know, completely static composition with nothing moving, like in, certain films, you know, you might have an 8-minute long shot of somebody sitting on a bed, not moving, you know, might express one thing. And then, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, you have a camera moving, people moving in these very choreographed long takes. So you have something like the beginning of Werkmeister Harmonies, where you kind of feel like you watched a whole edited sequence, and then you go back and look and it's just done through the choreography of the camera and the actors. You know, you feel like, oh, I got like two shot close up wide shot, because it's all sort of moving in this very particular way that it doesn't feel like the same image prolonged over a period of time. So yeah, there's a bunch of different ways of approaching it.
Exactly. Yeah. Mo, did you have any other kinds of long takes to add to our list?
For my favorites,
or no, just like different kinds, yeah.
I feel like a long take can be action driven. I feel like it could be very quiet. I feel like they can give a sense of a world, and I think that's really important to me. I think it is really about what type of movement the director wants to give. Some directors need it more for, you know, this is just daily life, where other directors are like, I need this to show you this is happening and this is important. And I feel like long takes are important. I feel like some people overuse long takes. Is it wrong that I say that?
No, please. No, if you don't, I will.
It's true.
There are some directors
Names,
where I'm
please?
Just like, ooh, where to start? Can I say that Zack Snyder is one of them?
Sure. Sure.
For some weird reason, it's especially with, I feel like a lot of younger directors feel like they need to have long takes. And I'm just like, and then they don't, to me, they don't always use them properly. Or they over, I feel like they are like, here's a long take. I'm throwing it in there.
Yeah.
Well, what Zack Snyder did at a certain point that sort of felt novel was changing the frame rate over the course of it, because that was something you could do sort of I mean, you could technically do it before if you like, I don't know, if you take a Bolex you could change the frame rate manually, but it was sort of interesting watching I mean, like, the his Dawn of the Dead remake has that great long take.
It does have a great long take. I will agree with that one.
You know, and but, like, I think, like, 300, it was the one really where there were these shots that went on for a period of time when you had it in regular motion and then slow motion and then sped up motion. Mm-hmm. So, like, I thought that was sort of an interesting take. And then, of course, it became kind of very quickly overused, like you said, and, like, not really to any particular effect outside of, hey, this looks cool.
Yeah.
But, I, as like a filmic technique, I always thought that was, you know, maybe interesting, if not squandered.
But, right. Yeah, and I, that's the thing. I was like, yeah, I do remember that was probably, that's probably my favorite long take by him. I do remember 300 having great, I did this thing where I revisited 300 and I was kind of like, what did I love about this film? And then I started really looking at films, and I'm like, yeah, I don't really like any of his films.
That's the way that goes, yeah.
Yeah.
I think your point is well taken. Like, I think that a lot of the reason why people employ these long shots is for showboating purposes, and it kind of tricks people into thinking that it's they're watching something spectacular when in fact this what they could be using the actual montage or normal editing structure to tell things more economically. So I mean, to me, this should I tell you my like my big controversial thing that I think is gonna get some people angry?
Sure.
I don't that long take in Children of Men, the famous one.
I know exactly what you mean.
There's no reason for them not to cut. It doesn't add anything.
And also, it's sort of interesting in that it's not actually one shot in camera. It's sort of several shots that were digitally stitched together. So, like, I like even as like a show-offy piece of like, hey, look what they can do. It's actually just a special effect. It's not
right. Yeah. You know? But as I was preparing for this topic, the Children of Men long take consistently came up as one of the greatest long takes in all of history. And I'm just watching it, going like, there's really nothing all that impressive about this.
It really did?
Yeah, absolutely. Consistently.
I can name like at least six things that are better than that. What?
But like, but I mean, in the context, like we're talking like, it's also a little bit of a, like an action type shot that kind of fits in with what somebody like Zack Snyder does. But like, I think it's sort of an interesting kind of point when you look at something like John Woo's films. You have that great long take in Hardboiled, mm-hmm. and the purpose of that is so you can appreciate the physical performances right. of the actors. You know, you're watching. It's the same as like when you watch dancing, like in Sally Potter's The Tango Lesson. You want to see it, like wide long take that moves right. with the actors and appreciate their physicality. I think sometimes in action or anything with like physical action, when it's like shot close and choppy, like it's not the best way to appreciate those types of performances.
Exactly.
You know, so like The Raid or Tony Jaa films, or even like Old Boy, the scene with the hammer, you know, I think like people probably do appreciate those partly because of the way it presents the action, the physical action of right. the performers. You know, you can appreciate it as you know, a little bit separate than if it was something that was maybe cobbled together from several different images.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that's, you just reminded me that I need to throw on a couple more things on my list. but anyway.
Actually, what's really funny is he kind of named two yeah. things I put on my list. I'm like, should I take those off now?
No, we can still keep them.
No.
Yeah, okay.
I'll switch it out.
Yeah. Well, I guess one point of clarification. How long do you think a shot needs to be in order for it to qualify as a long shot? This is a matter of opinion.
I think it depends on the grammar of the specific mm-hmm. film. Like, I think, like, the famous long take in Goodfellas isn't actually that long. Like, if you took that shot and plopped it into, like, a Hu Xiaoxian film or a Tsai Ming Liang film, you're like, hey, what's up with this fast-paced short shot? You know, like, I think it's sort of, like, long in relation to the established rhythm of the film. Right. You know, I think, like, some films, they can build up towards it, but, like, you know, for instance, Steve McQueen's first film, Hunger, there's a lot of long shots, but like if you talk about the long take, you know exactly which one it is because it's 9 minutes, middle of the film, it's like that's the long take because it's long in relation to everything else, you know.
All right, well, let's just let's get into it. Do you want to kick us off? I didn't even like really do any kind of, see, this isn't great radio because I should have had a very strict 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but I don't. I have to be honest.
No, I actually don't either.
Okay, well, let's list them off in whatever arbitrary order we want. It's much better when you rank things. People love lists. I love lists. But whatever. Pick one as number 5.
Okay, well, see, that's the thing. So I couldn't make up my mind.
Okay, fair.
So I have technically 8 or 9.
Okay, okay. All right.
But I will... I know a lot of people know this shot, but I reference it to another shot, so I'm going to say Kill Bill.
Okay.
The scene of her fighting in the tea house.
Yep.
I don't think of that as my long shot, even though that's the scene that everyone knows, and it is great. My personal reference is Lady Snowblood, which is one of my favorite movies that Kill Bill is actually based on. There's some wonderful long shots when it comes to just her walking, as well as fight scenes, and I'm just putting them together just because so many people know the Kill Bill shot, but I probably say that's my last on the list.
Okay, love it, Martin. Number 5.
I guess I'm gonna go with when the dog appears in Stalker. That's my favorite shot in the film, when the Stalker is laying sleeping, and the dog kind of walks up from the distance.
Yes.
I don't know. It always feels like, because it appears like above his head, like, I don't know, maybe conjures it in a dream, or maybe there's this dog roaming around in this this strange zone. I don't know. For some reason, I love that shot very much.
Fair. I love it too. Yeah. Can I? I'll just, in that case, I'm just going to make my number 5, since you have brought up Tarkovsky, I'll just say the ending of Mirror. With the burning house.
I'll take that off my list.
All right. In short, like, that's the third Tarkovsky reference on this show for those keeping track at home. It's been a long time. Good old Tarkovsky.
Those for keeping track at home. It's like my 900th Tarkovsky reference.
All right.
You have a favorite, okay? There's nothing wrong.
Nothing wrong with that. Wrong with it, for sure.
It's all good.
All right, number 4.
That's the thing. With me having 8 written down, I didn't put an order, so I'm just kind of throwing them out there.
Yeah.
We'll
save room for just missed at the end.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with the scene from Elephant.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. I feel like a lot of people, A, forget this film and how tragic it is. Uh-huh. I feel like the way that it's done, it's just a series of long shots. There's moments in it that, as a whole, just really stay in your mind. Especially, I personally connected to the one with the kids in the photography in the dark room. And that shot to me was really beautiful, and like I said, the entire film is kind of a series of connecting long shots, and I feel like I can't say more about it.
That's fit. Done. Elephant. I love it. Martin, number 4.
Probably one of the POV long takes in Catherine Bigelow's Strange Days.
Yes.
Like, I think especially the one where Ralph Fiennes is reliving this memory of going on a date. And one hand, it's technically impressive because you have this like amazing POV shot that's on rollerblades. And it's also very effective within the context of the film because it's meant to immerse you in, you know, somebody else's experience and memories. So I think that one's got to be up there for me.
That's a great one. My number 4 is just a piss take, and so is my number 3. Have you seen Der Lauf der Dinge by any chance, Martin?
Oh, I don't think so.
Okay,
no.
Yeah. That, it was like that weird 80s movie that was made in Switzerland by the art, like Peter Fuscelli and David Weiss. But the whole thing is just it totally sounds like something you'd dig. But it's like a half hour thing that's supposed to look like one long shot. But it's just this like weird Rube Goldberg that leads to nothing. It's amazing. Okay,
I'll definitely check have that to see one that out.
Okay. That's going on yes. the list.
Okay, number three.
I'm going to go with Old Boy, the fight scene.
Nice.
Probably one of the best fight scenes.
Martin has thoughts on Park Chan-wook. Do you care to share them, Martin?
You know, it's not like the kind of usual action scenes you see where like people just stay at their peak performance for the entire, you know, 10-minute long fight or however long it is. Like, one thing I really like is just you feel how hard it is for that character.
Yep. So it's not dumb then?
Yeah, well
I mean, the plot is, but...
Well, no. first of all, Old Boy's not his best film in the Vengeance series. That is Lady Vengeance.
Right.
Anyone who sees all three should know that, but a lot of people
Lady Vengeance is the best of the three, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm just like, have you seen Lady Vengeance? And then half the time they're like, oh, I've never even seen that. I've never even heard of it. I'm like, ah, just don't talk to me. But actually, with Park Chan-wook, a lot of his films actually have long takes.
Yeah.
Thirst has a beautiful one, too. I think for me, just that one stands out just because it is so taxing on the actors. And I had... technically three of my eight were action takes, long takes, and I just thought that one was just so well done. So it ranks higher, but honestly, if you ask me what's my favorite, you know, film by him, I was like, that might be like 5, 6, 7.
Yeah.
it's down the list.
Yeah, fair. All right. Martin.
We can have another take on that.
Yes. I'm just, I'm giving Martin a hard time because he's taken some flack for our 2016 in review show in which he says all Park Chan-wook films are dumb. So,
Martin, we're gonna have to talk.
We'll have to talk about.
We won't get into it. Open up a can of worms. But
okay, where were we at?
Number three.
Number three,
I think.
Right? I love the under the table shot in Oxide 2 because who thinks of that? And I love how perfect the framing is where, you know, the making the dumplings and the way she crouches down. And, like, of course, her face is just framed perfectly by the space in between the legs of the table and how the pot's placed. It's just like a perfect shot. And it's so interesting to watch. I love it.
Fair. Yeah, I think, so my basically, like, I can't with this whole thing.
were you going to say Russian art?
Yeah, no, I mean, like.
I feel like there's, like, a threshold to long takes, and, like, that's it. Like, I love Russian art in theory. You know, the idea of, like, oh, they're going to move through all these time periods without any cuts. Like, that's such an incredible concept. Right. And then 30 minutes, and I'm like, you know what I could really go for now is an edit.
An edit! I'm all about editing. I am so... Okay, so to me, the perfect way to make fun of... Naturally, my impulse is to make fun of this topic. But fortunately, our friends, the Python gang, are here for me. As they have already made fun of this concept already, you know. So I don't know if y'all recall, but in Monty Python and the Meaning of Life, there's a scene in which they make fun of surrealism. Right. The fishy fish scene.
Yeah.
Favorite long take, number three.
Okay.
Monty Python, Meaning of Life. Some great cinema right there.
That.
All right, number two. What do you got?
I really wish I chose that.
I know, right? Yes.
Oh, that's such a good scene.
It is a good scene.
My number two shot is actually from a Japanese film by Itami named Tampoho.
Oh, yeah.
Nice.
It is possibly my favorite Japanese film.
At least the most edible. It's...
Yes.
It is. And the shot that I chose is actually the ending shot, which is the baby breastfeeding, because it comes full circle. The, you know, this is an entire movie talking about food in so many different ways, and it ends on the note of breastfeeding, which is still quite controversial in the modern day.
True. And everything to do with motherhood, fraught.
Huh?
Everything to do with motherhood is so fraught, but yes. Go
true,
on.
True. And no, I totally agree. Yeah. I mean, I was just on the train a few days ago, and it was just, I thought that was a beautiful shot about food, and it was a beautiful shot about motherhood, and a beautiful shot about humans, and just the beginning of it. And to me, that's one of the best long shots in a comedy, in a film. It's very quiet, and I like it.
Yep, that's a great pick, Martin. Number two.
I guess the scene in Possession when Isabella Gianni's in the tunnel.
Oh yes.
Yeah, it's like. Like, I think, like, it almost goes, like, beyond acting. It's, like, this physical act. It's so extreme, you know, and there's sort of other versions of that in other Jaworski films. But, like, I think Isabella Gianni, and it's so incredible to watch, and it plays out for such a long time. The way she moves in the air, it's almost, I don't even know how to describe it. People just need to see the film. So that's, yeah. It's my number
two. That movie's great.
Yeah. Love
that
it.
That movie's great.
For my number two, I don't even know. Again, like, I feel like I should go with something like I Am Cuba, because that's like the most impressive shot of all time.
Don't do that.
That's okay, that's my... your number one. Okay, you
no,
got
no,
this.
No,
all right.
But it's close. It's
okay. I'll stop right there. But instead, I went with something that I was just randomly watching, and it's like, that's a great shot. This totally fits my list. So I was just watching 40 Guns, the Samuel Fuller movie.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a scene where Barbara Stanwyck's character is walking along with the local sheriff who's in love with her. And she's kind of being coronated by 40 different horses, which like flank her on both sides. And she's walking along having a discussion with the sheriff. And then she's got to get up on the horse and ride away and herd some cattle, and that's all done in one shot. And I'm like, you go, Barbara Stanwyck. That's my idea of a great long shot.
Oh, there's so many good ones in Westerns. I wish I'd thought more of, like, Red River.
Sure. All right, we're at number one, Moment of Truth. Mo, what you got? Favorite of all time.
So, I mean, until I brought him up earlier, number one is Ozu.
Okay, yes.
Tokyo Story, the table shot, and the family just moving through it.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one.
Possibly my favorite shot. I really was between this and the movie Riku, but I feel like this shot has been recreated by so many people now, because he was really the first person to really use a stationary camera and just leave it there, mm-hmm. and just place it there and let everyone around him speak for itself. And I feel like that is a moment in cinema, mm-hmm. you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. That's a great one. I love it. Let's see if we all go with stationary shots. Martin, you're number one.
Mine is not stationary.
Okay.
It's the opening shot of Letter Never Sent.
Ooh.
And I love Tarkovsky, but I sort of think that there might not be Tarkovsky as we know him without Mikhail Kalatozov. And I like that sort of strong break away from the Eisensteinian montage. But that opening shot, where everyone's waving goodbye to the helicopter after they're dropped off in the taiga, and it's getting further and further away, and they just get smaller and smaller and smaller, and you realize the enormity of the nature around them. It's there's almost something like existential just how tiny they are in relation to the environment. And of course, like, later on, it's a theme of the film, just how much bigger and more powerful nature is. I don't know. People don't believe me when I say I'm an environmentalist, because it's like that kind of
nature
environmentalism,
is scary,
you know,
for sure.
It's not like the, you know, like it's not the grizzly man. It's the Werner Herzog kind of mm-hmm. environmentalism. But I love that film. My father showed it to me when I was really young, and it left a big impression on me, that scale of it. And even though that film, it's like shot in 4x3 and in black and white, like it's not traditionally what you think of as like the panoramic cinerama color technicolor display of an environment, I think it captures maybe the enormity of nature in a way that I'm not sure any other film has. So I love that shot.
Yeah, and but not the, you went with the not so obvious.
I mean, Mikhail Kalatozov's shot, you could almost like pick out like any of his long takes, and it's the greatest long take ever made.
All right, I love it. My number one, it's really hard to pick one shot from this movie because it's a series of long takes, but we'll go with Jean Dielman preparing coffee at the end of Jean Dielman. How could it not be a Chantal Ackerman film for me, right?
Right.
Right. I mean, to me, the power of the long shot is it can be both awe-inspiring and it can be also a way to capture the perfect, the totally mundane. And I think what she manages to do is use the long take, but the power of the image comes both through what's being portrayed in the long take and also through the power of editing and juxtaposition, which, as you know, I think is a very important part of cinema. So this is my way of having my cake and eating it too, I guess, or having my pork cutlet and eating it too.
I mean, that's such a great pick too, because like so many long takes, you almost think of them as being separate from the rest of the film. But I think especially in Jean Dielman, like it's the long takes in relation to each other, and you're looking for maybe tiny differences or how they juxtapose. Yeah. You know, exactly. Everybody knows.
Everybody knows.
I'm not adding anything.
You know, well, you know, if you want to hear more about people prattling on about Jean Dielman, there happens to be a podcast you can listen to. Just look in your
where
iTunes
feed.
Where
people find this podcast?
Why, at www.flixwise.com. Under the episodes list. Or on iTunes/FlixWise. Give it a try. All right. just really quickly, I think we're running a little bit long, but some honorable mentions. I do want to just give a shout out to, you know, Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. As Martin was saying, like, there's a reason you don't cut away. Like, that, to me, is the purpose of a long take, is so that you can see the full dance routine.
Oh, right? I know. Like, if I had a number six, it would be the airport dance in the tango lesson. That it's so amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my god. So many long takes.
For me, I have three that I feel like people should see.
Uh-huh.
Well, four. One is The Protector. Anything with Tony Jaa will have great long takes just because he's amazing. Quitting. I think Quitting has some beautiful long takes, especially when it's revealed that they're actually acting everything out on stage.
Yeah.
Rikyu, which is actually pretty much just, you should watch it just because it's about the tea ceremony and the guy who pretty much made the tea ceremony what it is. And there's beautiful long shots of the preparation of tea, of his death. There's just some really beautiful cinematic moments. And Three Iron. I think Three Iron is a beautiful film, and it has some of the, you know, for characters not to ever talk to each other, it has this, those really beautiful shots of them together. And those are my picks.
Love it. All right. Lest I leave you with some poo-pooing of long take, let's close things out with some things I do like. It's time for our final note of positivity. Martin, what's one movie, book, article, song, TV show, like you watch TV, that you've been digging lately?
Well, I have watched Key and Peele, and last night I did see the theatrical directorial debut of Jordan Peele, Get Out, and it's a horror film. And I think, like, even if you don't know anything about Jordan Peele, like, I think people are still going to really appreciate the it's excellent at balancing the creepy and horrific, also with the sort of satirical and things that lean a little bit more towards the comedy side. It's like a very well calculated tonally film. It's fun too. I think it's also maybe the kind of film that the less you know about it,
the better, but everyone should see it. Go and see it.
All right. I think by the time we release this, it will probably be out of theaters.
Probably. See it on video. See it somehow.
Yeah.
See it with a friend. See it by yourself. See it with the green eggs and ham.
I love it. All right. Mo, how about you?
I'm planning on seeing that, actually. Yeah. My positivity is A, Moonlight 1.
Yes.
Picture.
Which
is amazing.
Will be very old news by the time this comes out. But yes, always cause for celebration. Yes.
But,
Moonlight 1.
Actually, I have been trying to catch up on films, and a film that just makes me happy that I just saw was Sing Street, actually.
Oh, all right.
It's been out for a moment. But it's, for me, it was actually the best musical, better than La La Land. Mark my words.
Interesting.
it's true.
It is. It's I liked it so much more.
Fair.
But it's one of those films that just makes you happy, and the music made you happy, and like you don't know where those characters are going in life, but you're happy for them, and that's my positivity.
I love it. Yeah. I think that was my favorite film of that director's. I'm one of the few people who does not care for Once at all. But
oh, it's so sweet though.
I know.
I fell asleep like 5 minutes before the like, I think that movie is exactly like 7 minutes too long because it's always right before the end. I'm like, let's just finish it tomorrow. And then it's like, no, there's 7 minutes left. So I'm positive it's like exactly that amount of time too long.
Yeah,
I'm glad I'm not the only person who fell asleep through that. That's why I was pleasantly surprised by Sing Street.
But I'm glad he's getting better. I'll put it that way. All right. So mine, I have mine's sort of like nebulous, but my roommate recently got a Fandor account, and I have been reaping the benefits. And she also has Mubi, and so now we have Filmstruck, Fandor, and Mubi, and my life is complete. So if you need me, I'll be watching random Soviet cartoons. It's just Fandor especially, is great because it has a Roku app, whereas Filmstruck does not. Get on that, guys. And Fandor is great if you, are looking to have all of your free time sucked into a void. How's that for positivity? And that's the way we frame it, FlixWise, that is. Listeners, do you have a favorite long take that you want to share with us? Come let us know on our website, FlixWise.com, and you can come tell us on our Facebook page, Facebook.com/FlixWise. And if you want to come yell at me about my Children of Men comments, you can find me on Twitter. The handle is @FlixWise. And you should probably just follow me anyway, even if you don't want to yell. But before you do all of that, be a human being and go show us that you appreciate all of our toiling and struggling. Have mercy on us. Go to iTunes, subscribe, and rate us. Tell your fellow film fans that we are your one-stop shop for all your Mizoguchi / Rube Goldberg appreciating needs. What more could you ask for in a podcast? Honestly. all right, yeah, go do that. On our next show, we have Jean Eustache's 1973 Bohemoth, The Mother and the Whore. It's gonna be great.
That sounds like it's gonna be something.
Yep, it's gonna be something. That is true. Okay, so stay tuned for that. Until then, Mo, it's been a pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you so much. And I had a lot of fun.
I'm so glad to have you. Where can folks find you on the internet?
I am on Twitter as Dark Momo Speaks. You can pretty much just message me or stalk me.
Okay.
I'm on Tumblr under Blue Chrome 2002. I mostly talk about fandom stuff, and I do talk about films from time to time on there, but it's mostly just kind of fun stuff. You can also listen to the podcast, Beacon Hills After Dark, DDHD podcast. There's two minor podcasts that go along with that. One is on the show Shameless, and the other one, the American version. I have to point that out.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is on Hiatus, which is the one on Empire, because we need to catch up.
Ah.
And that one, we mainly talk about the Shakespearean references.
Oh, all right.
And music outlook, and the musical outlook and past.
Okay.
And when we're not rambling about Supernatural and how great Supernatural is. So, so yeah.
Love it. I love it. Yeah, I always feel like I could do some kind of TV podcast. Like, there's so many, like, dumb shows I think make for great recaps.
Exactly. And that's why we chose Teen Wolf.
Good call.
Because we watched it one during a marathon, and it was so dumb, and we're like, we have to talk about this.
Yes.
And it kind of, it's more us having a love-hate, mostly hate relationship.
Right.
But we do like the cast, and we support, and, you know, it's really about, I enjoy talking to other fans about stuff.
Yeah.
But half the time I'm rambling about how they copied Buffy, or they copied the show, and I make all the really geeky, nerdy comments about what they're referencing and how I could be watching something else.
Right, right. So, I love it.
I'm a party pooper.
all right, cool.
Thank you so much for having me on here.
Of course, yeah. And Martin...
Liddy P.
Thanks for coming on.
Well, thank you for having me on this episode in specific and on the show and in general. It's always a pleasure.
Yay! Oh, what a great love fest we have.
It's
all
a disaster. It's a complete ecological disaster.
That I never thought I'd hear it, Martin. This is amazing. This is terrific.
I've been holding it in all these years. But thank you.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, guys. On that note, let's steer clear of the water.
I like that anytime we talk about a serious film, it ends up just turning into like a laugh riot.
It's true. let's do this then. All aboard.
All aboard, Sancho the Pit.
Oh boy.